Henry Colleges. I take that to mean that he has the best of both worlds, a Presbyterian education and Methodist degrees. After serving Methodist parishes in eastern Pennsylvania, including two of Philadelphia's finest, St. James's Church and Old St. George's, he served as district superintendent. For 8 years, he served as a consultant to the General Commission on Archives and History. And a few years ago, that's where our friendship took up again from my few years in Philadelphia. More recently, he has served as the first executive secretary of the World Methodist Historical Society. Long active as a lecturer and writer on Wesley and the people called Methodist, Dr. Mazur has authored or edited 3 books, several pamphlets, and a host of periodical articles. He contributed to and was a member of the editorial board for 2 major publications, the 3-volume History of American Methodism Project, published in 64, more affectionately known by the students in my Methodist history course as the HAM series, and the Encyclopedia of World Methodism Project, published in 1974. More recently, he spent the bicentennial year lecturing on 18th century church history at churches and institutions from New England to Florida. And throughout his busy life, our Tipple lecturer, like the person for whom this lectureship is named, spent a good deal of time visiting antiquarian booksellers, at home and abroad, poring over their shelves and catalogs, selecting the choicest Wesley and Methodist items. Not since 1938, when the Ezra Squire Tipple collection of Wesleyana came to our university library, have we had so splendid a collection to celebrate. And how glad we are that the Mazur collection now joins the Tipple collection, greatly strengthening an already strong research collection in Methodist libraries at Drew University. For those of you who are unable to join us this morning for the dedication of that collection, I've brought along copies of the descriptive brochure with a very entertaining essay by Dr. Mazur on Tales of a Wesleyana Collector. There are a few copies in the back of the chapel, more copies downstairs in the lounge on the first floor. For all of these reasons, I am delighted to present to you a very dear friend to deliver the first of 2 Tipple lectures for 77, entitled The Unknown John Wesley, Dr. Frederick E. Mazur.
I ask my good friend Ken if I could have a drink of water, and someone, I won't tell you who, said in the back, that looks like straight vodka. Coming as the second lecturer today, I would say that I have a hard act to follow, but I feel very honored to be here to deliver this Tipple lecture. Now, as it's written here, as you can see, it would take me about a solid hour and a half to read it, just as it is. But have no fears, I have already cut it down so that we will keep within the hour, and I have a watch here so that if the time gets short, I can quickly turn to the last pages and cut the lecture even more. But just remember that you should be thankful for what you are not about to receive. And if you grow tired of this, remember, there's more where this stuff came from. But I won't blame you if you doze off a little. These are comfortable pews. I wear bifocals, and I'll not be able to tell whether you're awake or whether you're asleep. They do say that if you take all the people who fall asleep in church and lay them end to end, they would be a lot more comfortable. Now, both this lecture today and the one tomorrow will be somewhat controversial. You may disagree with me, but then I'm in the hands of friends, and so I'm not so frightened about that. Tomorrow is on the Aldersgate experience, which already is coming into the press for a great deal of controversy. This is the unknown John Wesley. Despite the fact that John Wesley probably wrote more about himself than did any other character of the 18th century, with the possible exception of Horace Walpole, his personality still remains an enigma. The situation has been complicated both by Wesley and his followers. Wesley carefully edited his journal and some of his general writings for the sole purpose of edifying his readers. The result is that certain facets of Wesley's complex personality must be conjectured from those rare, unguarded statements that suddenly illuminate the inner recesses of his mind, as when a person opens a shutter into a shadowed room, allowing the rays of the sun to penetrate the darkness, and then quickly closes it again. Wesley's followers throughout the history of Methodism have tended to support his self-made image. With the exception of John Hampson and Robert Southey among his earlier biographers, and possibly Francis McConnell, Ronald Knox, and others of more recent vintage, few narrators have freely admitted his faults. In addition, the student of Wesley is seriously handicapped by the lack of critical texts, critical analyses of Wesley sources, and general inaccessibility to such important writings as Wesley's diaries. However, with the publication of the critical text of Wesley's works now underway, this situation should be remedied. With these limitations in mind, then, my purpose today in speaking on the unknown John Wesley is to outline briefly some of those traits of his personality, incidents in his life, and emphases in his thought, which I believe have not been given sufficient attention or have not been sufficiently researched to produce a three-dimensional rather than a one-dimensional picture of the founder of Methodism. In short, my paper is a series of comments on some underdeveloped problems areas in Wesley biography. To begin with, most biographers have in some measure written about the influence of his parents in shaping the character of John Wesley. But few have clearly focused on his mother's success in planting a sense of divine mission deep within the heart of Wesley. In addition, few have recognized in Wesley's management of persons' lives the same firm hand that characterized his mother's control of the members of the Wesley household. This is not to eliminate other ways in which Susanna influenced him, nor the importance of his father's influence on Wesley's personality. His father, as well as his mother, inspired him with a love for reading and learning, and helped to mold in him that kind of integrity and courage that gave him strength in later years, always to face a mob instead of running away. Caution and faint-heartedness were bred out of him. Both parents played a part in developing his theology. Susanna, in particular, may have influenced his views on Holy Communion and Christian perfection. Both parents inoculated him with a love for the Anglican Church, and according to recent word from Dr. Albert Outler, we now know that John also learned a good deal of his homiletics from his father, including his father's code of abbreviations. His father's efforts, however, were encouraging and confirming. His mother's were decisive and motivating. Susanna herself pinpoints the hour when she first resolved to pay a special attention to John's education. It was in 1709, when John's rescue from the fire that destroyed the Epworth Parsonage impressed his mother to the point where she wrote, "I do intend to be more particularly careful of the soul of this child that thou hast so mercifully provided for." Sometime later, Susanna read an account of the Danish Halle mission to southern India in a book entitled Propagation to the East. After reading the report, she was fired with a missionary zeal. She could think of little else. She decided, however, that since she herself could not carry the gospel abroad, she would do what she could with her own family. She therefore set aside an evening every week for each of her children to talk to each privately about his or her concerns and to instruct them in religion. John's evening was Thursday. Wesley was in the most formative years of his life, and these dialogues must have had a decisive influence upon him. It's inconceivable, moreover, that inspired by her reading and her firm belief that John had been saved from the Epworth fire for a particular purpose, that Susanna would have failed to have impressed him with a sense of divine mission. Indeed, Wesley became one of the few 18th century divines who understood the task of Christianity in terms of mission, a legacy probably from his mother. In addition, having been converted from dissent to Anglicanism as a girl, Susanna had developed a deep respect, awe, and love for the Church of England. It is reasonable to suppose, therefore, that she planted in John also a sense of the significant role of the Church in mission. The point is important, since it was probably through these Thursday night dialogues that the Church became indispensable to his life. Although in later years his sense of mission forced him into certain actions tantamount to separation from the Church, the Thursday dialogues were probably what kept him within the Church. They triumphed over the strongest pressures to separate Wesley from the Church of his mother. There is no doubt that John deeply loved her. It might be well to note here that Wesley's relationship to his mother needs greater research than it has received. A certain mystery surrounds their mutual affection. Ordinarily, Wesley signed his letters to his mother, "Your dutiful son." On March 19, 1727, he began to sign his letters, "Your affectionate dutiful son." His mother, not an especially warm-hearted person, noticed the change immediately and answered with a certain reserve, as though she did not feel comfortable with the new term. "The conclusion of your letter is very kind. That you are ever dutiful, I very well know. But I know myself enough to rest satisfied with a moderate degree of your affection." There are not many extant letters from Wesley to his mother over the next 5 years. But in February 1732, Wesley writes a letter filled with what might possibly be interpreted as audible overtones. It reads in part, "You have more than once said you loved me too well and would strive to love me less. Now this is what I complain of. You say you have but little time to stay in the world, and therefore should not show much affection for anything in it. Most true, not of those things which perish with the world. But am I one of those? If you think I am sick unto death, love me the more, and you will the more fervently pray for me, that I may be healed. If you rather incline to think there is hope of my recovery, then what if you are to leave the world in a little time? Whom God hath joined, can death put asunder? Yet a little while, and if you return not to me, you will certainly be overtaken by your dutiful and affectionate son." The strange comment about being sick unto death, the reference to the line in the wedding ceremony, the strong desire to join her in death, suggest a desire for a closer relationship than she seemed at that time willing to accept. How this affected him has never been thoroughly analyzed, but such an analysis might help us materially in painting a full-length portrait of John Wesley. We may gain fresh insights on this question, however, with the publication of Wesley's diary and the letters that may have been discovered in recent years. Whatever is to be made of this relationship, it is obvious that he so deeply loved her that her conduct became a criterion for his life. Her management of the members of her household struck a responsive note in his mind. Her close supervision of her family seems to be reflected in Wesley's own desire to supervise the lives of all those who came in contact with him. In part, at least, it was probably the difficulties he faced in closely supervising the lives of those students at Oxford who put themselves under his care that caused him at first to refuse to become his father's successor at Epworth. In his father's parish, there were 2,000 souls, and the thought of closely supervising the lives of such a number of persons benumbed him. He wrote, 2,000 souls! I see not how any man living can take care of 100. At least I could not. He would probably have had the same reaction toward the whole Methodist movement had it not been for two things. First, the Methodist movement unfolded gradually, and the necessity of caring for a large number of souls was not thrust on him all at once. Second, the Methodist movement, as it grew, created its own structure that made for a tight chain of command, which enabled Wesley to supervise in some measure the life of every person who joined the Methodist ranks. In spite of this, he himself did at times talk personally with all the Methodist membership in some places in an attempt to separate the precious from the vile. It is safe to say, therefore, that two strong motivations of Wesley's life, a profound sense of mission to be expressed through the church, and a call to manage for good the life of everyone whom he met, and especially of those who sought his help and care, had their roots in the heart and life of Susanna Wesley. It was she who transmitted them to her son. And it is difficult to understand Wesley aside from these motivations. Now, a second phase of Wesley's personality which needs researching is his sexuality. That is, the strength and mastery of his sexual powers. There is a great deal of evidence that throughout the greater portion of his life, Wesley possessed a strong sexual drive. The strength of his desires may have at times surprised Wesley himself. Although those strong impulses are revealed only in unguarded statements, when the inner recesses of his heart are illuminated for a moment before the shutter closes again. It is in this general area, I believe, that we can find the explanation for his conduct toward women, as well as their response to him. His sexuality may also lie at the root of his search for Christian perfection, and the reason why he himself never claimed the perfection he sought. Wesley fell in love not only with Sophie Hopke, Grace Murray, and Mrs. Vizell, but apparently a host of other women, a phase of his life on which his biographers seldom elaborate. In his youth, for example, he may have been in love with Sally Kirkham and even considered marrying her. Later, Wesley seems to have fallen in love with Kitty Hargraves. A few words in Wesley's diary, as supplied by Vivian H.H. Green, are revealing. After writing briefly on the necessity for self-denial in the Christian life, he adds a resolve, never touch Kitty's hand again. Later he makes a resolution that he would never touch any woman's breasts again. In the 18th century, of course, that would have been considered a mild form of eroticism. But the very necessity for the resolution suggests something about his conduct at this time. We have no way of knowing how well he kept his resolution. He continued to see Kitty and to enjoy her company. It is significant that this affair with Kitty was not ended by his own action, but by his father, who apparently saw some things in the situation which he did not approve, and he sent Kitty packing. Wesley writes that his father sent Kitty away in suspicion of my courting her. This phase of Wesley's early life needs further study. The materials for the necessary research should be provided by the publication of Wesley's diaries in the Wesley Works Project. Till then, we must speak tentatively and not conclusively. Wesley's relationship with women on board the ship Simmons to Georgia and later in Georgia, and his affair there with Sophie Hopke, are too well known to need rehearsal here. But what is often overlooked in the account is Wesley's own consciousness of an almost uncontrollable sexual drive. In writing from Savannah to his brother Charles at Frederica, he included several lines in Greek, so that were the letter lost, it would be unintelligible to any but Charles. One of these sentences reads, "I stand in jeopardy every hour. Two or three are women, younger, refined, God-fearing. Pray that I know none of them after the flesh." The last sentence is unexpected. It startles one like a clap of thunder threatening a storm on a calm summer day. It is not the expression of a man in whom the sexual drive or impulse burns dimly. There seems to be a driving force here that is mastered only with difficulty and through religious help. To be sure, though often in her company, Wesley probably had very little physical contact with Sophie, but this may have been because he rigidly controlled his impulses by his manner of life. He chopped down trees in Georgia. He planted a garden. He played the flute. He wrote letters and sermons. He walked long distances. He called on his parishioners, served for a time as Oglethorpe's secretary, read books and kept a diary, visited the Moravians, sang their songs, translated some of their hymns, and published his first hymn book. The Georgia picture is of a well-proportioned, muscular, open-faced man, strong, handsome, though short of stature, with a square, dimpled chin and chestnut hair. His sexuality explains in part his indefatigable drive and also his attraction for women, a trait he had in common with his master, who also was often surrounded by women. A virile man is always attractive to the opposite sex. Wesley's indiscreet letters to numerous women later in his life can also be seen as a release from his sexual drive, a method by which he unwittingly chose to sublimate forces he could not completely understand. He was unconsciously converting the energy of instinctual drives into forms acceptable to his religious convictions. He often intertwines expressions of affection for those to whom he is writing with religious advice, and thus transforms what would otherwise have been merely outpourings of personal feeling into pastoral admonitions and Christian directives, so that the letters become more an expression of agape than evidences of sensual love. Now, this is not to impugn his sincerity, but to explain why at times the sensual outruns the spiritual. Some of his biographers tend to make him look like a fool in his relationship with women. Others dismiss his letters and actions as a sign of emotional immaturity. Still others laud his letters as beautiful expressions of agape. For true understanding of Wesley, one must consider his letters to women in part at least as a form of sublimation and a release from inner tension. He wrote out his desires in spiritual terms and found some measure of satisfaction. In 1775, he writes to Anne Bolton, "I cannot easily express that union of spirit which I feel whenever I think of you. If I do not see you till we meet in a better world, surely our disembodied souls shall join. Surely my friendly shade shall mix with thine. A little over a year later, he wrote in a letter in a similar vein to Hetty Rowe, using the very same lines of poetry. He evidently expected a shady time in eternity. Now, those who believe that there can be no sexual overtones in these letters because they were written when Wesley was past 70 forget that, like the eminent jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes, Wesley cannot be judged by ordinary standards. Few octogenarians could write as Wesley. I am never tired either with writing, preaching, or traveling, and believe me, he proved it. He traveled all over in his 80s. And fewer still would begin a revised translation of the New Testament at 84 years of age. It is significant also that aside from the letters he wrote to women while he was at Oxford, the bulk of the letters to females were written after his heartbreaking experience with Grace Murray and his disappointment in his wife. Another curious fact is that, though not so frequently, Wesley uses terms of endearment in addressing men. He often impresses one as a person longing for affection and understanding. This also may have been a result of his relationship with his mother. As we have noted, she was not an especially warm-hearted person, and Wesley may have unwittingly felt that she never wholeheartedly returned his deep affection for her. And the result may have created a hiatus in his life, which again and again he sought to fill. Biographers have almost universally blamed Wesley's wife for her intense jealousy of her husband's relationship with other women, implying that her suspicions were unfair and unfounded. But they overlook the fact that Grace Murray, likewise, found Wesley's predilection for women frustrating. While she and Wesley were courting, she temporarily cooled her affection for him and reopened her correspondence with John Bennett because through gossip in Bristol, she heard of an affair between John Wesley and Molly Francis. These illustrations are not given to charge Wesley with immorality, a charge that could not possibly be sustained, but rather to call attention for the need of understanding those forces which he seemed under the necessity of keeping in rigid control. One method was in letter writing, another in ceaseless activity, and still another in the daily search for Christian perfection, that love for God and man which results in holiness. He apparently never found the perfection for which he searched until possibly in the article of death. And the reason he never claimed Christian perfection for himself may possibly lie in the fact that he knew his own heart best. And he was shocked at times, as he had been in Georgia, by his own earthly desires and impulses. In closing this section of my paper, I call attention to the statement of Joseph Sutcliffe in his manuscript History of Methodism. In commenting on Wesley's marriage, he says, "Now, though the marriage of four of the holy club, who boasted of the gift to be eunuchs for the kingdom of God, were not encouraging, yet they operated on the preachers to marry." The key words are, "who boasted of the gift to be eunuchs for the kingdom of God." Sutcliffe, who lived through some of the things about which he wrote, had no reason to falsify his statements. He was a friend of the Wesleys. His statement indirectly points to the inner drive that must have unsettled Wesley, the leader of the Holy Club, to the point where he gave up his original dream of celibacy to take the marriage state. Even as Wesley cannot be understood aside from his primary motivations, so he cannot be treated fairly without an appreciation of the powerful libido, that instinctual craving or drive which lay at the core of his personality. Third, it is impossible to understand Wesley without a knowledge of his theology and an understanding of his Aldersgate experience. This latter subject will be dealt with in our second lecture, and that's becoming a more and more controversial issue. Ordinarily, we do not think of Wesley as a theologian, certainly not a systematic theologian, but he had a theology, the core of which lay in his views on soteriology and his contribution to pneumatology. From here, his ideas fanned out in a wider and wider circle, becoming less clear the further he wandered from his central theme. In studying Wesley's thought, full scope must be given to an analysis of his sources. He was not an original thinker. His theology is eclectic. His reading was prodigious, and he seized any idea that furthered his aim. He can best be understood in the light of what he appropriated from others. Few biographers have grasped the full sweep of his theology because few have pursued the tangled threads to their original sources. He remains for most biographers, therefore, a glorified evangelist and social worker rather than an earnest preacher with a well-defined theology. Now, this statement must not be pushed too far. As we have indicated, there are limits to Wesley's theology, limits set in one sense by his purpose of evangelism. But he had a theology. Indeed, he stated that in some measure it was based on the articles of religion and the homilies of the Anglican Church. Because Wesley's thought is eclectic, he sometimes becomes contradictory and even perpetuates questionable interpretations. Being a practical rather than a speculative thinker, for example, he never wrote a careful statement of his Christology. He had a Christology, and he tried to explain it to a Roman Catholic, but it is a brief statement suggesting the work of a figure skater rather than a depth diver. Wesley's Christology must be gathered from his references to the work of Christ. In some ways, it might even be pronounced faulty. Dr. John Deschner, for example, believes that in Wesley's Christology, there is a lack of emphasis upon the humanity of Jesus, although he does not go so far as to mark Wesley's teaching as docetic. In short, Wesley exalts the deity of Jesus while at the same time idealizing his humanity. For example, Wesley dislikes the expression in John 11:33, Jesus was troubled. It suggested too clearly for him that Jesus shared the emotions and passions of humanity. He prefers the translation, he troubled himself. This he terms an amazingly elegant expression, full of the highest propriety, for the affections of Jesus are not properly passions, but voluntary emotions. Now, both Wesley's translation and comment have been seriously questioned. Wesley also reveals a duality with regard to the Virgin Mary. On the one hand, he upholds the Catholic tradition of her perpetual virginity, while on the other hand, he sharply repudiates any adoration of the Virgin, and indeed places her in the ranks of ordinary believers, for whom backsliding is an ever-threatening possibility. His doctrine on the atonement, though anselmic, is fragmentary, and his views on eschatology contradictory. After reading the Reverend Thomas Hartley's book on the millennium in 1746, he wrote to the author, "Your book on the millennium was lately put in my hands. I cannot but thank you for your strong and seasonable confirmation of that comfortable doctrine of which I cannot entertain the least doubt as long as I believe the Bible." Hartley had laid down a carefully drawn picture of the premillenarian position. Some years later, in his sermon on the general spread of the gospel, Wesley seemingly advocates the postmillenarian position. It is difficult to understand what view of eschatology Wesley actually supported, except that in his notes he attempts to steer a middle course. He also held what today might be termed peculiar ideas on the resurrection of the body. But these must be attributed more to his sources than to his interpretation of the Bible. His sermon on the resurrection of the dead was abridged from a sermon published by Benjamin Calamy in 1726 in 13 sermons preached on several occasions. It was included by Wesley in the Christian Library. In it, Wesley states that our present body will be raised from the dead. Now, this, of course, creates problems. Our bodies relapse into the dust out of which they came and are dispersed throughout nature. Wesley, following Calamy, poses the question, what happens when a cannibal eats a man? Does his body intermingle with the body of the cannibal? Not so, argues Wesley. God preserves the first man's body, and by a miraculous procedure, prevents it from nourishing the body of the cannibal. That'll show that fellow. Or if it does, it shall wear off and be separated from him. Now, this theory becomes understandable only when one realizes here that Wesley is setting forth a medieval idea that received restatement not only from Calamy, but in the 17th century through John Donne, and in the later 18th century through the writings of the scientist Joseph Priestley. It is an example of Wesley's eclecticism and the care one must take in analyzing Wesley's thought. Ronald Knox, in this connection, is impatient with Wesley for his apparent lack of critical judgment. He quotes Wesley as writing, "A man full of words but not of understanding convinced me of what I never had seen before, that all the souls of his posterity, as well as their bodies, were in our first parent." Knox comments, "On a point so momentous and so abstruse, he is prepared to believe one doctrine for two-thirds of his life and to believe the exact contrary for the remaining third of his life on the strength of a single interview." It should be noted, however, that Wesley, on October 25, 1763, inserts in his journal a lengthy extract from a letter arguing strongly in favor of creducianism, the doctrine he then seems to accept in opposition to his own exposition of Hebrews 12:9, which seems to lean toward creationism. Now, you probably know the difference between these two doctrines. I happen to be a creationist. But the traditionists argued that the soul, as well as the body, was passed on from the parents to the children. The creationist argued, not so. Every soul is a direct act of God. And therefore, it is a direct act of God either at the moment of conception or at the moment of birth. Now, this is a very important question currently because the Supreme Court has come up with a decision. I think it's after 3 months. They, of course, have a direct line to God, and so their opinions would be of some value. However, they're not too far away from some of the history of the church, for Thomas Aquinas believed that the soul was created 40 days after the moment of conception, that is, the male soul, and the female soul somewhat later. But there are these... See, that all goes back to Genesis, where God created man out of the dust first, and then breathed the soul into him, and then created women, and then we've had trouble ever since. But that is by the by. That's not written in the text. The truth is that anyone dealing with Wesley's thought must be prepared for changes in Wesley's theories, which makes it impossible to place him in a well-defined slot. Always one must ask, at what time of his life did Wesley believe this, and how does it compare with what he believed earlier or what he believed later? Also, how much of this is the result of Wesley's matured thought, and how much a hasty abridgment of something that temporarily appealed to him. Wesley's central doctrine, and the one which aroused the greatest opposition, was his doctrine of Christian perfection. Here the important, but not the only difference between Wesley and his opponents was in point of time. The Methodists, and those who Wesley termed our brethren who differ from us, agreed that many of those who died in the faith were not made perfect in love till a little before death. The main point of difference arose when Wesley insisted we should expect to be saved from all sin before the article of death. In short, he was suggesting that if a person can be made perfect in the article of death, why not 10 minutes before death, a day, a month, 6 months, 6 years before death? Here again, one must read Wesley carefully, for he often changes his stance, and I've written the changes herein. The sources of his doctrine are numerous, although Wesley himself names only three: Jeremy Taylor, Thomas A. Kempis, and William Law. He fails in particular to mention the sermons of his grandfather, Dr. Ainslie, and the teachings of his mother. Susanna's statements on perfect love, as one would expect, lack the warmth and fire of her father's views. Here is the way her father writes: "When the love of God is shed abroad in the heart, 'tis like the breaking of a ball of lightning. It sets all on a flame immediately. It is the unspeakable enlargement of the heart towards God. The highest rhetoric is too flat to express it." Again he wrote, "Remember these two words, though you forget all the rest of the sermon. That is, Christ and holiness. Holiness and Christ. Interweave these two words in all your manner of conversation." Well, Susanna could hardly match that, could she? But she does say this: "To know God only as a philosopher will avail us nothing. Unless the heart perceive and know him to be its supreme good, unless the soul feel and acknowledge that she can find no repose, no peace, no joy, but in loving and being beloved by him." As previously stated, Wesley's relationship and his debt to his mother needs more research. And a project helpful to Wesley students would be the publication of a critical text of all of Susanna's letters and works. A further fruitful project for a doctoral thesis would be a very careful study of his father's influence on Wesley. Another important doctrine of Wesley's which needs further study is his view of prevenient grace. Within the limits of this lecture, the Wesleyan doctrine of prevenient grace can best be understood by contrasting it briefly with Calvinism and Pelagianism. Like the Calvinist, Wesley believed in the total depravity of man, insisting that it is impossible for man to save himself by any merit or initiative of his own. But differing somewhat from the Calvinist, he argued, there is no man that is in a state of mere nature. There is no man who is wholly void of the grace of God. No man living is entirely destitute of what is vulgarly called natural conscience. But this is not natural. It is more properly termed preventing or prevenient grace. Every man has a greater or measure of this which waiteth not for the call of man. Again he writes, "There is a measure of free will supernaturally restored to every man, together with supernatural light, which enlightens every man who cometh into the world." This, briefly stated in Wesley's words, contain his most important ideas on prevenient grace. As a man through this grace exerted his God-given freedom to choose aright, he would receive more grace until he was enabled to accept the gift of justifying and saving faith, and by his own choice, the gift of perfect love or Christian perfection. Now, the Pelagian, on the other hand, argued that man, by his own efforts, took the initial and fundamental step towards salvation, entirely apart from any assistance of divine grace. Unfortunately, as Ronald Stromberg makes clear in his book, Religious Liberalism in 18th Century England, Many Anglican divines had drifted into Pelagianism under the guise of a form of Arminianism, which to Wesley was little better than deism. Now, in short, Calvinism placed the entire initiative and responsibility for human salvation in the hands of God. Pelagianism placed the responsibility for salvation in the individual's unaided efforts. Wesley, through his doctrine of prevenient grace, offered a third alternative. Fundamentally, it might be considered synergistic, but it was sufficiently grounded in the grace of God as to give God the dominant place in the scheme of salvation without removing entirely one's responsibility for working out one's own salvation. For as Wesley quoted, "It is God who worketh in you." Today, predestination or Calvinism, with its accompanying doctrine of election, may well be submerged, it seems to me, by the rising tide of peoples everywhere claiming for an equal share of life's good. No election there. Pelagianism has already foundered on the rocks of catastrophic wars and humanity's inability to cope with problems largely created by humanity itself. Wesley's doctrine of prevenient grace, however, is still a viable concept. What is needed is a fresh, sound presentation of the meaning and implication of the Wesleyan doctrine of prevenient grace, one that will capture the imagination and thinking of the church and give direction to its evangelistic and ecumenical program. Wesley is alive and well, but unfortunately unknown to a large portion of the Methodist Church. Now, fourth, any full-length portrait of John Wesley must include an adequate explanation of his success. Here, biographers generally overlook the fact that Wesley was a man peculiarly designed for the 18th century. Despite his singleness of purpose, his tight organization, and his obvious call from God, I doubt if he would have had success in any other era of church history that marked his work in 18th century England. What was 18th century England like? Numerous biographers of Wesley stressed the skepticism of a nation where the very mention of religion in some circles was cause for laughter. They point to the low morals and vile language in a country where a servant is supposed to have said, "I could not make out who she was, but she swore so dreadfully she must have been a lady of quality." 18th century England, they say, was a nation whose ideals were gross, whose sports were brutal, whose public life was corrupt, and whose vice was unashamed. The church sought only to maintain the peace of the status quo. Biographers delight in painting this Hogarthian portrait. Now, it must be admitted that there is some truth in this caricature. But there are certain definite reasons why Wesley was a success, aside from the overcoming by the spiritual power of this dissolute England. To begin with, 18th century England, in spite of the fact that it was part of the Enlightenment, was still, especially among the common people, a very superstitious nation. Satanism and malign incarnation were generally accepted, and widespread belief in demonology is attested by the names given places and corners: Devil's Dyke, Devil's Kitchen, Devil's Dressing Room, and so forth. Defoe wrote essays on apparitions and magic, and as late as 1768, the eminent jurist Blackstone wrote, "To deny the possibility, nay, actual existence of witchcraft is flatly to contradict the revealed word of God." In addition, the 18th century people to whom Wesley administered were woefully insecure. Their superstitions must have given them sufficient cause for fright, but further fears were caused both by political crises and physical phenomena. England sounded with tumult. It saw rebellions in 1715 to 16, when the old pretender sought to regain the throne, and more seriously in 1745, when with the aid of the French and the Scots, Prince Charles Edward advanced by way of Scotland as far south as Derby. He was not finally defeated until 1746. In addition, the Wilkes and Liberty riots shook the country in 1768 and the Gordon riots in 1780. Through the century, the country was engaged in four great wars: the Austrian Succession, the Seven Years' War, the War of American Independence, and the first half of the French War. In 1750, two earthquakes twice shook London. A fanatical soldier predicted that a third earthquake would engulf London on April the 8th. Smollett wrote, "The open fields that skirt the metropolis were filled with an incredible number of people assembled in chairs, chaises, and coaches, as well as on foot, who waited in most fearful suspense until the morning, and the return of the day disproved the truth of the dreaded prophecy." Newtonian astronomy had cleared the air of some superstitions, but most of the people to whom Wesley had ministered were the superstitious, the insecure, the poor, and the frightened. Who in the 18th century would have been more fitted to understand and preach to these multitudes than Wesley? He was himself a superstitious man. He held to a firm belief in witchcraft, demonology, and a kind of Miltonian heaven and hell. In his journal and the Arminian magazine, he recorded numerous incidents of demon possession, and with the unreasoned logic of his most ignorant readers, he accepted many of the accidents of life as caused either by the intervention of the devil or the judgment of the grace of God. He believed that not only the Lisbon and London earthquakes, but even a landslip in Whiston Cliffs in Yorkshire, which seems to have done no harm to anyone, were decidedly miraculous. In short, he was a man acceptable to the common people of his day. In many ways, he was one of them. In all fairness, however, it should be noted that although he believed earthquakes were the evidence of God's wrath against sin, he never believed the wild prophecies concerning the end of the era. Now, he met superstition and insecurity with plain dogmatic preaching surcharged with emotion. It has often been stated that he never centered his sermons in hell. He was not a hellfire preacher. That's only partially true. Hell in its most terrifying form is referred to in numerous sermons, if not directly, then indirectly. But it must be remembered that Wesley did not need to threaten his hearers with hell. He only needed to assume its reality. He knew his hearers believed in it. This explains one aspect of his preaching that is often overlooked, namely that in his sermons he did not constantly argue about the truth of his doctrines. He simply assumed their truth and explained and applied them. Other 18th century preachers delivered polemical or moral essays. Wesley in his sermons laid hold of an important doctrine, clarified its meaning, and added a practical explanation and exhortation. And the exhortation was one that the ordinary man could understand. Samuel Johnson, with his customary perspicacity, was probably correct when, in explaining the success of the Methodist itinerant, he said, "To insist against drunkenness is a crime because it debases reason, the noblest faculty of man, would be of no service to the common people. But to tell them that they may die in a fit of drunkenness and show them how dreadful that would be, that cannot fail but make a deep impression." And that was the way in which the Methodist preacher spoke. So often we think of Wesley merely as preaching in a conversational style, but a closer look at his journal shows that he was often carried away. "I began about 7, Wesley writes, "but could not conclude till half an hour past 9. He was carried away. Samuel Bradburn, who often heard him preach, says this: "The torments of hell and the sufferings of the Son of God he set forth in such an earnest and serious manner as greatly affected both himself and his hearers. He entered into the spirit of his subject and felt what he said. I have seen his lips quiver and tears run down his cheeks when with a most moving language he was entreating his congregation to live for eternity." In this connection, We want to answer a serious question raised by Jan Ramage. What we want to know is whether the very numerous conversions of the evangelical revival were in fact what history has supposed them to be, a genuine work of grace in which men and women were set free for spontaneous Christian living, or whether they were simply due to a process of psychological manipulation in which Wesley and his preachers imposed their beliefs on people whose capacity for genuine independent thought and action had been broken down by the ordeals of evangelism. Now, I reject the either-or implication of this statement and opt in limited measure for a both-and. God cannot be eliminated from the Wesleyan revival, but neither can John Wesley. The two certainly work together. He was a man peculiarly designed for the 18th century. I go on to describe other ways of thinking about Wesley, complementary ways. You know so many of the complementary things that I need not go into them. On the other hand, a different but fertile field of inquiry about Wesley has been largely overlooked. Why did many of his critics think Wesley was insufferable? What was said of him in periodicals such as the Gentleman's Magazine and in newspapers? What did objective eyewitnesses, travelers, historians have to say of him? For example, a German traveler in England, writing in the early 19th century, states that in every respect, Wesley was admirably qualified for accomplishing a revolution in religious sentiments of the vulgar. For, he adds, such a strange medley of spiritual arrogance and of Christian humility, of stupid infatuation and of subtle hypocrisy, of stubborn obstinacy and unbounded versatility, of rusticity and refinement was absolutely requisite to revolutionize the rabble of the 18th century and to establish a religious community in England, and apparently he believed Wesley possessed all the necessary qualifications. Now I go on at great length about some of these others, but time is very, very coming close to 4:15, and I know most of you are hungry for the reception that is going to be given, and so I'm going to jump over clear to the end. Wait, I got to the notes for too far. Clear to the end of this and come down to the very last part. In his sermon, The Signs of the Times, Wesley saw in Methodism a sign as important as the coming of John the Baptist or the ministry of Christ. In his sermon on the laying the foundation of City Road Chapel, London, he followed a similar train of thought. After outlining the history of Methodism, he states, "I do not remember to have either seen, heard, or read anything parallel." Now, his heady satisfaction with the work of Methodism is understandable. Beginning as an obscure movement, ridiculed and persecuted, Methodism had grown in numbers and in respectability. Methodist was no longer a term of contempt or disdain, and Wesley himself had become a legend in his own time. Wherever he went in his old age, he was greeted with awe, respect, cordiality, and love. Great crowds came to hear him preach, and although the people could not always hear his weakened voice, they seemed content simply to gaze upon his placid, cheerful countenance, encircled by his long, neat locks of white hair. When he died, it was like the passing of a beloved monarch. The king was dead, but among his followers, the grief was the greater, because there was no one to whom they might have shouted, "Long live the king!" This strange, enigmatic, beloved, yet hated preacher, pastor, pope, and king had appointed no one to succeed himself. His body rested in state while thousands of weeping souls passed for one last look at their friend and master. Possibly none of them understood him or really knew him. But he knew them, and he understood them, and in his own way, he loved them. For what other reason than to bring them the Word of God. Had he ridden on horseback or in a chaise, or traveled by ship throughout the whole of the British Isles for more than 50 years, such a man was sure to be loved, whatever his faults. No one can despise a person whose chief aim in life is to do good. Most people will respect a person who boldly states that he knows the will of God, even though they may doubt his claim. They know it is important that someone care sufficiently to try to discover what that will might be. This is why thousands followed him. Numerous leaders in the 18th century were moral zeros. Wesley was a shining light. He did the best he could for all of England, and the rest was in the hands of God.
Dr. Mazur, for an interesting and stimulating presentation. We'll be adjourned until 6:15 for the banquet, the reception immediately to follow, the lecture tonight, 8:30. Well, it was marvelous. Well, you twitted us.